From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a call to reform Michigan's civil asset forfeiture laws.
They took so much of his personal property, including a television and his phone, and he's fighting to keep his house. And again, never convicted of a crime.
Beyond the battlefield, back home again. What we get wrong when talking to vets.
You know, the most intrusive question is that gets asked more than you would believe. So have you killed anyone? Just all the time.
Civilians and veterans both have conceptions and biases that feed the awkwardness.
Becoming Ernie Harwell, the play telling the story of the beloved Tiger broadcaster, opens for its fifth summer.
You just mention Ernie to somebody and everybody has a story.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. People all across Michigan have seen police seize their homes, cars, TVs, their kids' iPads. And that's even if they've never been charged or convicted.
An agent of the government, whether it's federal or state, seizes your property and you've never been convicted of a crime, but then you have to hire a lawyer and prove that your property is innocent.
I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, opposition to Michigan civil forfeiture laws is growing. But first, people can be really bad at talking to veterans, especially combat veterans. We get awkward. We freeze up. We say, thank you for your service. But then what? As part of our series, Beyond the Battlefield, we talk with lots of vets about these awkward interactions. Before we talk with someone who knows how civilians can do better, let's hear from a couple of vets.
My name is Brendan Lejeune. I was in the United States Marine Corps, and I served in Fallujah, Iraq in 04, 05, and 06.
So my name is Sherman Powell. I served in the U.S. Army from 1995 to 2006 as an officer for the majority of my career.
We are asked inappropriate questions so very often. As an example, this happened to me just a few weeks ago with a person I worked with. It came out that I was a veteran. The very first question they asked was, oh, so you must have post-traumatic stress now. And I know it wasn't meant to be rude. It was just, that's the image that they're given of us in the media and movies and television shows.
It's funny, the interactions usually go as follows. The individual stops what they're doing and says, oh, thank you so much for your service. And then they kind of freeze up and they don't know what else to say. And so I kind of have to move the conversation forward myself and say, you know, no problem, it was my pleasure. And then we just move on to the next thing quickly.
You know, the most intrusive question is that gets asked more than you would believe. So have you killed anyone? Just all the time, which is an incredibly rude question.
From 8 or 9 years ago until today, there's been a bit of a change in the sense that we were treated almost like celebrities, almost like rock stars. And now I think a lot of people think, oh, gosh, I feel so bad for you. You must be this poor, helpless, damaged thing, and I'm gonna offer you my deepest sympathies. And I don't know what else to say to you.
Aaron Smith is with us now to help shed some light on how we talk to vets and how we should talk. She's a psychologist with the VA Ann Arbor Healthcare System. Really good to have you with us, Aaron.
Thank you.
Why is it, do you think, people sometimes have that feeling of awkwardness or not knowing what to say when they meet someone and find out, for instance, you know, I served in Fallujah? Mm-hmm. Why do we have that awkwardness?
Well, I think sometimes it's a novel situation. People haven't met anyone who served in combat before. And when you're in a novel situation, you might not know exactly what to say. I also think that as part of our larger culture is the awareness of the way the Vietnam veterans were treated and some of the negative experiences they had when they came back from combat. With that awareness, people don't really know what to say or are concerned about maybe possibly offending a veteran by saying something. I also think it's awkwardness on the part of the veterans sometimes, because their experiences can be that people have asked questions or that they're concerned that people might ask questions that are emotionally upsetting for them or distressing. So when something's kind of the largest thing in your mind, the most emotionally salient part of what you're dealing with, it might be the first thing that comes to your mind. So even if someone asks a pretty neutral question, they might start thinking about something that's upsetting for them.
Good point. So, you know, we all know that we can say, thank you for your service. But what if the vet is someone you're closer to and you do want to go deeper? You want to show interest and you want to show concern. But then, as you pointed out, for some of these veterans, it goes places they don't want to go. So, you know, what can or should you say or ask without digging in, and particularly if someone's dealing with post-traumatic stress?
Yeah, I think you can say thank you for your service, but that in of itself is actually a pretty complex issue. For some veterans, it feels like when you're saying thank you for your service, they volunteered. This is the job they trained for. They're part of a larger team. And so being singled out by someone to say thank you for doing your job kind of feels awkward. They might not know what to say. I also think in a deeper level that when someone says thank you for your service, veterans are aware of their friends, people they served with, other veterans who have made extremely costly sacrifices, and sometimes the ultimate sacrifice. And so in a way, being thank you for their service, they're thinking about these people that in their minds deserve that more, and that can be a very emotional experience for them.
What should we say instead?
You know, that's a good question. And I think in some ways, if people got to know veterans, they might be able to ask that question. Instead of kind of looking at them as a uniform and a public figure, I would say get to know them as a person first and someone who served as part of who they are. Ask them questions about what they do for fun or what they do or why they're taking the class that you're in, just to get to know them instead of asking questions about their service. If you do want to ask questions about their service, I think there's questions you can ask that veterans would feel comfortable answering.
Like, such as?
Why did you join? What are some of the proudest things that you did while you were in? What are the things that you most enjoyed while you were in? Veterans and the camaraderie that they have is impressive, and they love to talk about their friends and the fun things that they have done with their friends. So ask them who their friends were and what are some of the things that they did, where they lived, what they did in the military. But don't ask them questions like, did you kill anybody? Did you see dead bodies? Did any of your friends die? Was it horrible over there? And I think it's actually very common that veterans experience that. And that goes back to that idea of kind of awkwardness that comes about. And I think some of that is just also the conception and prejudices and perception that people have about combat and combat veterans. And if you haven't interacted with them, then your experience is kind of these newsreels and news bites.
Hollywood movies,
exactly.
Yeah.
And so when you're asking questions, don't ask questions in that voyeuristic way of
like, ooh, was it like we saw in American Sniper?
Exactly. Yeah. In a way to be entertained. These are people's real lives. And when you ask questions like that, there's real memories in there for them. And those memories are, even if they're not traumatic, it can be emotionally charged and painful. The biggest takeaway would be respect the level of the relationship you have with someone. If you wouldn't ask the same question of someone who was not a veteran, ask them the most distressing day of your life, tell me about that, then don't ask a veteran that question if you don't have that relationship with them.
I'm talking with Aaron Smith, who's a psychologist with the VA Ann Arbor Healthcare System, on how we talk to our vets. Aaron, I'm wondering, because I know at the VA Ann Arbor Healthcare System, you're working with generations of vets. And I'm wondering, are there generational differences that you've seen? And by that, I mean, do the post-9/11 vets have a different set of sensibilities or concerns than, say, Gulf War vets or Vietnam or even further back, Korea, World War II.
Generational differences, I think there's differences because they're at different stages in their lives and their combat is different between Vietnam and World War II and now. And I think one of the things that is happening now in the current conflicts is soldiers and service members are surviving incidences they wouldn't survive in previous combat.
I understand. Is that what you're saying? A wound or an injury that would have left you bleeding out and dying on Omaha Beach, you're medevaced, you're in a hospital and you're home with a whole lifetime of challenges that you have to overcome.
Yes. Yes. I think that's one of the major differences. You might have died before and now you survive that. I think technology is an interesting issue to also look at. And I can speak to my personal experience with that. My sister was deployed early into Iraq, and my brother has deployed twice to Afghanistan, and I've had friends and loved ones deploy. My brother's experience of deploying was different than my sister's. We would get letters, postcards, very, very rare phone calls. Whereas my brother, because he deployed later to Afghanistan, we had email, we had Skype, we had the ability to talk to him. And I think that introduces things. So when you think about the stresses of being in a combat situation and then add onto that the ability to be connected with your family members at home and
looking at them on a screen while you're Skyping.
Yes. And to know that there's problems with the kids not doing their homework, or that your, you know, wife is, or your boyfriend or your husband, they're feeling lonely and they're kind of needing something from you and pulling for that. I think it adds to the demands that veterans can experience. So I think that might be a generational difference.
So what I'm hearing, just to kind of focus down, drill down on the do's and the don'ts as we talk with our post 9/11 combat vets, is don't look at the uniform, isn't it? Don't think of the uniform and don't think of where they've been, but just take it as a person, and then what happens happens.
Yeah, and the conversation. I think there's a couple of other ones that I would highly recommend. Listen. Just listen to what they're willing to share and respect what they're willing to share. Don't prod, don't push. Let them share. Much more likely, if there's someone that you care about, to share if you listen. And don't talk politics, because the political decisions that are made have very personal impact on these people's lives and the lives of the people that they served with and they care about. And so people can talk about politics in a very abstract way. And it feeds the conception, I think, that veterans have that civilians don't really understand what's going on. You know, civilians and veterans both have conceptions and biases that feed the awkwardness. There is a conception that all veterans who go into combat come back with PTSD, and that's not true. When you look at the numbers, it's really 11 to 30%, with returning veterans kind of falling somewhere into the middle of that spread. That perception is not helpful because it perceives these people as damaged, sometimes kind of unstable, and that's not true. And so if people have that conception of combat veterans in their mind and then they try to interact with someone, they're going to be awkward because that's how they think about that person.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Great, great food for thought as we encounter more and more returning combat vets post 9/11. Erin Smith is a psychologist with the VA Ann Arbor Healthcare System and chief of the Post-Traumatic Stress Clinic. Erin, thank you for your insights.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And tomorrow, as our series Beyond the Battlefield continues, we talk with a Detroit group trying to create a community space for returning vets to live and to work. That's tomorrow on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It was 2009 when the wrecking ball finally took down Tiger Stadium. Since then, volunteers who love that historic site at the corner of Michigan and Trumbull have maintained the field. They call themselves the Navin Field Grounds Crew, harkening back to the ballpark's name a century ago. Now they fear the grass from that old Field of Dreams could also vanish. Dave Mesri is with the Navin Field Grounds Crew, and he's joining us now from the field at Michigan and Trumbull. Dave, what's led you to think the grass may be replaced with artificial turf?
Thanks for having me. Well, those discussions have been ongoing for more than a year. I'm privy to the conversation. And we've been doing what we've been doing here for 5 years, cutting the grass, picking up the garbage. You know, to a lot of people, Cynthia, this is truly sacred ground. People come here all the time to scatter the ashes of their loved ones. And just the other day, as I was walking onto the field, there were two people out there. And it was a man from Toledo proposing to his girlfriend on the mound. And she said yes. And so for them, they may end up getting married here. We occasionally have weddings here as well. So this is a sacred site to many people, and it's been an honor to preserve it as long as we have. I mean, the only thing left of the stadium, Cynthia, is the flagpole in center field. And other than that, all we have is the grass. And so we'd like to see it retain its historic integrity. We would be unique among major league cities throughout America by keeping the field in its historic configuration and by keeping it a natural grass field as well.
And we know that plans are afoot by the Detroit Police Athletic League, PAL, to put its headquarters at Michigan and Trumbull, and then to create a multi-sports center that the public would still have access to the field. Is that correct?
Well, that's up to PAL, but we have lobbied them to maintain at least a limited amount of public access, because it truly has become a tourist site. People come here from all over the world. People come from Europe and, of course, all across the country just to see where all the greats played. From Ty Cobb through Willie Horton and Alan Trammell and Lou Whitaker. And the infield diamond is still in the same configuration that it has been since April 20th, 1912. And a lot of people say this is the Field of Dreams. And an interesting side note, you know, the movie Field of Dreams is a great movie. And in it, of course, Shoeless Joe Jackson, you know, walks out of the cornfield in Dyersville, Iowa to play baseball. Of course, that never happened. But the real Shoeless Joe Jackson actually scored the very first run of the very first game here at Navin Field on April 20th, 1912.
So much history, so much history. Dave, have you heard without a doubt that the grass will be replaced with synthetic turf when Detroit PAL starts developing the famous corner?
That's their proposal. The Detroit Police Athletic League is a great organization doing great things for Detroit's kids. Their proposal, though, is indeed to tear out the natural grass here and put in artificial turf. And their reasoning behind that is that they want to program the site 250 days a year, 12 hours a day with baseball, football, soccer, lacrosse, you name it. And we just hope that they would reconsider. I mean, if they build their headquarters here and use the site for youth sports, we think that would be great. We just think that natural grass is the way to go, and there are plenty of other diamonds in Detroit where their kids can continue to play, and perhaps this diamond could be used instead of a showcase field for various championships and other PAL special events. But if they put in artificial turf, we've basically lost everything but the flagpole, and so we're hoping to maintain the grass while still supporting Detroit's kids.
You have a petition going on change.org asking them to please keep the grass there. How has that gone? What kind of response are you getting?
The response to our petition so far has been overwhelming, Cynthia. The comments on the change.org petition were really more than we anticipated. And we're getting some big-name people commenting on there, from local journalists such as Anna Clark to nationally known writers such as Charles Learson, Ty Cobb's biographer, and Dan Epstein, a well-known baseball writer based in Los Angeles. They've all commented that the grass is worth saving. In fact, to quote Dan Epstein, well, to paraphrase him, he said that putting artificial turf on Navin Field is like putting aluminum foil on the Mona Lisa. And it's hard for us to argue with that.
I've got to ask you, Dave, you've been hard at work, volunteer for over 5 years with the Navin Field grounds crew, keeping that site intact, as there were debates back and forth about what's going to happen to that site. And there have been so many plans, and many of them having nothing to do with sports whatsoever, strip malls and lofts and condos. This is about sports. It's also, PAL is there to provide opportunities for Detroit's kids. Would you rather see the site being used that way rather than not at all? I mean, if you have to look, would you rather see the site being used for sports activities for kids or no development at all and leaving it right as it is?
That's a tough question, Cynthia. Opinions vary among the locals and the grounds crew, and it's come a long way since 2010. It was 9 acres of garbage and weeds, and the weeds were 6 and 7 feet tall, towering over our heads in the footprint of the grandstand. And so we've worked hard and long to restore it to a playing field again, and you know, we're not professional groundskeepers. We're merely amateurs with a passion for history and a passion for the game. And we really do like things the way they are. And there's certainly room for improvement. And we're really not sure what's going to happen from here on out. But the reason we launched the petition is, for no other reason, is to maintain, you know, it's really all we have left, Cynthia, is this natural grass. And of course, there are plenty of studies out there indicating that artificial turf is not only bad for our health, but bad for the environment. So we hope that the city will reconsider their proposal for artificial turf here.
And as you said to me, you do admit this, you're there out of love. It's not your field, but you've been the caretaker. Could it be that your time as caretaker of the corner is having to come to an end?
Yeah, it could very well be, Cynthia. And, you know, when the time comes for us to pass the torch, there are other fields in town that we can move on to. As a matter of fact, in Hamtramck, there's one of only 6 Negro Leagues ballparks left standing in America, Hamtramck Stadium. And we'd certainly like to lend a hand over there and help to restore that diamond as well, because that's where the Detroit Stars and Turkey Stearns played, and Satchel Paige and all the great Negro Leaguers who never got a chance to play here at Tiger Stadium.
Dave Mesri, who is with the Navin Field grounds crew, keeping the history of the Field of Dreams alive at Michigan and Trumbull. Thanks for talking with us, Dave.
Thank you, Cynthia.
In 1960, Ernie Harwell became the voice of the Detroit Tigers. In September 2009, as he battled terminal cancer, Ernie took his final bow at Comerica Park.
In my almost 92 years on this earth, the good Lord has blessed me with a great journey. And the blessed part of that journey is that it's going to end here in the great state of Michigan. I deeply appreciate the people of Michigan. I love their grit. I love the way they face life. I love the family values they have. And you Tiger fans are the greatest fans of all. No question about that.
We now bring you a rebroadcast of our 2014 conversation with Michigan actors Peter Carey, who plays Ernie Harwell, and T.J. Corbett, who plays the boy. Peter, this play actually is set on that final night at Comerica Park in 2009. Give us a sense of how the story's framed.
Well, you know who sets it up the best is T.J. as the boy. Because here's the thing. He sets this whole thing up for Ernie. You're right. It is at Comerica Park. But there's a little twist on it.
It's on, like you said, the final night. He gives the farewell speech. And Ernie was a very humble, self-effacing guy. So he's kind of talking out into, you know, the fourth wall and says, well, Lulu, it's time for me to come home. And he's about to leave when seemingly out of nowhere, this kid dressed in 1930s clothing shows up and says, I want to hear your broadcast. And Ernie says, well, I don't broadcast games anymore. And the kid says, well, I want to hear the broadcast of your life. So Ernie tells the kid the nine innings of his life.
And the kid has to work a little to get him because Ernie's so effacing. Yeah. He wants to go home to Lulu.
Got a lot of practice at being annoying. So,
well, TJ, you've been doing this play now. This is since it first opened in 2011. What most strikes you over these years about the audience reactions that you get?
It means a lot to a lot.
Yeah,
of people.
Yeah, it means a lot to a lot of people. And what I guess what strikes me the most is the people who come back. Really, I mean, a lot of times people see a play and go, "Oh, that was great. That was great. We'll talk about that forever." But they just keep coming back. Sometimes more than once in a season, let alone people who come just once a year for the new run.
We had a gentleman the other night say, this is my third time seeing the play, and it's my first time seeing you as Ernie. So that people come back. They love the feeling, the energy that Ernie is and was. I say is because you just mention Ernie to somebody and they, oh, everybody has a story.
And when, as you talk to people, and now we should note that this is your first time leading as Ernie. You were understudy, so this is your first season. So you're coming out, people are waiting, but you're also seeing and feeling from the audience. What is it, do you think, people love about this man?
Well, I think we've mentioned this previously, that TJ and I, that when you were with Ernie, you were his best friend. You were the most important person in that room because he made you feel that way and you got his full attention. And he was the most endearing individual I've ever met and worked with. And I was thrilled to have the opportunity.
So here you are portraying this icon. He is beloved. He's iconic. How do you take someone who's that important to people and make it something that has audiences going, oh, yeah, that's Ernie, but not be doing an impersonation? Was that a tough balance to strike?
It is. That's a great question. You don't want to be an impersonator. You want to channel Ernie. You want to respect his spirit and who he was. And at the same time, give people a sense of come along on this journey with us through the nine innings of Ernie's life. And working with TJ has been wonderful because we've really had an opportunity to explore not only Ernie's life, but how to best portray it and share it with people.
Mm-hmm. How do you work at that, TJ?
Well, oh, he's just good.
Sometimes you just got it. But I guess a lot of it is, and the gentleman who played Ernie previously, Will Young, had, I guess, he phrased it in a way that I guess just kind of came about from the little, like, talkbacks they do is, we're careful to not make him a caricature, but he's a character. And it's not, you know, people understand that they're not coming to see a 92-year-old man. They're coming to see a character portrayed as a 92-year-old man. And I think it kind of helps with us finding the fun in it and finding the back and forth in the play. Mm-hmm. And like Peter said, really embodying that spirit, like that humility, but that joyous, embracing just,
he found joy
being.
In everything. You're
yeah,
right.
He was just humanist. Is that the right word? I don't want to misspeak.
But this is also a man at this time who knows he's dying.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Very aware he's dying.
Oh,
so
absolutely.
That brings a whole different level to your acting and how you experience this whole thing. And that's one of the things I want to give a big shout out to Will for building Ernie for the first 3 years and doing such a wonderful job. And as an understudy for the last 2 years, I learned a lot from him. And I dearly love Will. And when Mitch came and said, okay, we're bringing you up from the farm leagues. You know,
moving up from Toledo.
That's right. He's coming up from the mud hens. So that was a big step. And you take a giant leap in from understudy to lead. You bring some things that you want to do.
Would you share a scene with us?
Sure. We could probably... Do you have a favorite you'd like to do?
There is a point toward the end where the boy and Ernie are talking, and Ernie kind of goes through his calls.
Oh, the iconic calls.
The iconic calls, and then a recognition of where he's at in his life.
Two for the price of one.
I'm sorry?
What, you'd sand double play? Do it, please.
Grounded a trammel over to Whitaker to Evans. That's two for the price of one.
Yeah, do another.
Strike three looking. He's called out for excessive window shopping.
Yes.
That one is long gone.
Long gone.
Long gone. Like me pretty soon. I'm dying.
I know.
I got this thing in my bile duct. Cancer. They can't operate. I wouldn't want them to. I don't want to go out in pieces, radiated, cut up and vomiting. I'm 91 years old. You can just say goodbye and be grateful, right?
Are you afraid of dying?
And then we go into a very emotional...
Yes, we do. And there was sniffling galore from the audience, which...
I love telling the husbands, like, bring tissue. And yeah. I like, look at the wife and I'm like, make him bring a tissue.
Because they do. And we heard lots of snuffling around it. But Peter, you actually had... You come out, both of you, and talk to audience members after. And you had a special conversation the other night with someone with the last name of Hardwell. Talk about that to us.
Well, for us... For TJ and I to come out and see this, there was this big hulking gentleman out in the lobby, and he had this thick Georgia twang, and he introduced himself to us, and then we're in awe because it's Ernie Harwell's nephew, and he introduced us to his wife and his son. Now, not giving away a lot about the play, but there is, in the early innings, he talks about his brother Davis, and, well, this is Davis's son, and his son is named after... his grandfather, so his name is Davis. And
we didn't put this together till after
yeah,
the show.
After the whole show.
Everybody went home, and then we're like, wait a minute. Was that Davis's son?
Yeah, we're texting each other going, wait a minute. Wait, is this? And so it unfolds for us later on, but it's very moving because we were talking to him, and you wonder, how did you honor the man to this family member? And he said, we had tissues out 2 minutes in, and his wife gave me a big hug and a kiss, and she said, you have no idea what you did in terms of bringing him back. So,
wow.
Yeah, it was, she was barely hanging on the whole time. I mean, it was like she was on right on that fence of just breaking down into tears.
And we're with her.
Yeah.
I'm not going to lie.
Tears. That does really hammer at home what really a responsibility it is to do honor to this man that's so beloved by so many. It really struck me that Ernie is really a story about more than sports, that it takes us through so much of the 20th century in America and in Michigan through Ernie's eyes. And I'm wondering what each of you think. What was Ernie Harwell's Michigan?
Oh, my gosh. Wow. Do you want to take that one first?
I guess you haven't been asked that question before.
No. That's why I love coming here.
Go read his poem, Baseball.
Yeah.
That, I think's probably the biggest thing. And then I think it's everything Michigan. Go to Tiger Stadium. Go to Detroit. I don't know where he traveled. I'm sure it's in some of his books. Just, I'm sure Michigan was home for him. So
he loved it and was loved by it.
Yes.
It was this exchange of energy and love and respect. And he honestly was heartbroken when Tiger Stadium was torn down.
Yeah.
And there's a line in our play that came straight from him. When they tore Tiger Stadium down, it felt like they were taking a piece of me, too. And so it is. It's a mutual love. It's an admiration. And he was an icon and still is. You go to Comerica Park and you tap on that bronze statue.
Yeah, absolutely, every time.
I get a little tingle.
Well, Peter Carey, TJ Corbett, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Mitch Albom's play Ernie opens tomorrow, July 9th, for a fifth and final season at the City Theater in downtown Detroit, and then hits the road for Traverse City and East Lansing. You can get the schedule at ErnieThePlay.com. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Police can seize your property in this state if they as much as suspect that property's been involved in criminal activity. It's called civil asset forfeiture, and the pushback is growing against it. A new coalition of conservative and progressive groups has come together under the name Fix Forfeiture. It's made Michigan one of the three states it's targeting for reform. Holly Harris is the senior project director for Fix Forfeiture. Holly, why Michigan?
Michigan is a target, first of all, because there are some very reform-minded individuals and leaders in Michigan who are looking to reform your civil asset forfeiture laws there, and they need to be reformed. Our ultimate goal with Fix Forfeiture is to push the entire process post-conviction, which means that no agent of the government can seize your property unless you've been charged with or convicted of a crime. But there's also some other very important components. For example, right now in Michigan, the legislation that is moving has already passed the House of Representatives in overwhelming numbers. But the focus of this legislation is transparency and reporting. We do know in Michigan that since the year 2000, more than $250 million in forfeiture revenue has been collected by Michigan law enforcement agencies, with more than $24 million in cash and assets in 2013 alone. What we don't know is whether those seizures and forfeitures were ever connected with a criminal conviction. At the federal level, 80% of individuals from whom the government seized funds or property were never charged with a crime. So we know this happens a lot. We know of so many instances of abuse in Michigan. But again, we're really excited that there's some leaders willing to step forward and push reform there.
And it's interesting. We in Michigan, you don't often see groups as conservative as the Mackinac Center and as progressive as the ACLU joining hands and working together.
Exactly. And I think that's what's so remarkable about Fix Forfeiture. We are actually comprised of seven of the country's most prominent conservative and progressive voices. I mean, when the ACLU agrees with Americans for Tax Reform, agrees with the Center for American Progress, which agrees with FreedomWorks, you know, that's when you know there's a serious problem and it's time to get to work on a solution. And it's interesting, all of these organizations come from a different perspective. I mean, obviously with the ACLU, you know, they're focused on civil rights, but then there's the liberty perspective, the property rights perspective, the perspective of government overreach. So regardless of where, you know, these organizations are coming from, they all agree that this practice is wrong and is really in need of reform.
Give us some for instances, if you will, Holly Harris. How have we seen people's lives be upended by civil asset forfeiture laws in Michigan?
There was an individual by the name of Darlene Hellenberg, who's a librarian, who was a victim of the what is now known as the Cade Raid. She was going to an art party, and all of a sudden, the party was raided, and she was never convicted of a crime. But law enforcement seized her vehicle, and she didn't have the money to get her vehicle back. And so for 10 months, she had to go without a car. We know of an individual who's a cancer patient who had a medical marijuana license, and his home was raided. He was thrown to the floor and handcuffed. They took so much of his personal property, including a television and his phone, and he's fighting to keep his house. And again, never convicted of a crime. And that's just wrong. And so our goal, again, is to ensure that law enforcement, and we hope that law enforcement has the same goal, is that they focus on the bad actors, which is why, you know, requiring a criminal conviction is so important. We then know that the process is focused on bad actors and not entangling innocent property owners in this process.
So that's what you're saying. It isn't that you are against police agencies being able to seize homes, televisions, cars of the bad actors and then taking that money that they get from it, putting it back into their operations. You're saying wait until there's a conviction.
Absolutely, Cindy. And I'll say, you know, a lot of people don't know what civil asset forfeiture is because, again, there's been very little transparency. It's sort of a very secretive process. We're just now getting more reporting in the states and at the federal level. But basically what happens is, in most cases, an agent of the government, whether it's federal or state, you know, seizes your property and you've never been convicted of a crime, but then you have to hire a lawyer, go to court and prove that your property is innocent. These cases are actually against the property. And so, you know, again, that cuts against, you know, the very foundation of our criminal justice system, which is innocent until proven guilty. These innocent property owners, never convicted of a crime, have to go and prove their property innocent. An individual said to me the other day, it all sort of smacks of the Sheriff of Nottingham. And I laughed at that, but it's just so true.
We know that Michigan's House, as you mentioned, has approved a reform package, an eight-bill reform package, including increasing burden of proof required to keep seized property and new reporting and more transparency by police, and also to keep police from impounding a vehicle used to purchase less than an ounce of marijuana for personal use. I'm wondering, does that package sync up well with what you are hoping to see in your work with Fix Forfeiture?
It does. In fact, you know, it satisfies three of our policy goals. And again, the real challenge in Michigan, and we're seeing this across the country, is that there's no stringent reporting right now. And, you know, most legislators, when they are implementing policies, they want it to be data driven. And so right now there really is no strict reporting data, which is what this package of bills is going to require. And again, you know, once that data is in hand and we can see how many of these seizures and forfeitures are actually connected to criminal convictions, if it mirrors what's happening at the federal level, well, then we know it's time to go further.
What are you hearing as Michigan Senate gets ready to take a look at what the House has done?
Well, we were really honored to be joined by House Judiciary Chair Clint Kesto in our launch call the other day, and he stated that he is having those conversations right now with the Senate. We feel very hopeful. This issue has really got a lot of momentum behind it, and it's not like this is a partisan issue. I mean, you've got the ACLU and the Mackinac Center, Americans for Tax Reform and Freedom Works, you know, all in agreement that this process needs to be reformed. So I think there's just so much momentum. You know, we really haven't heard much out of law enforcement, but we're actually hopeful that at the end of the day that law enforcement will come to the table and even endorse this package. So in Michigan, there's a perfect storm right now, and we really feel like there'll be a hearing in the Senate, and we're very hopeful that this package of reform proposals will fly through the Senate.
And just to kind of crystallize it, Holly Harris, tell us why you believe that everyone listening to our conversation, what do you want them to understand about Michigan's civil forfeiture laws right now? Why should we care?
Because it could happen to you. You always think it can't happen to you until it does. And we know that this is a growing problem. We know, you know, that it's big business for law enforcement. And most seizures involve $300 or less. So most of the people who have their property or their cash seized, you know, why would it be worth their while to hire a lawyer and go to court? It's just such a grave injustice. And again, it can happen to anyone. And so, you know, our goal here is to ensure that no agent of the government can take your property without due process of law.
Holly Harris is with the group Fix Forfeiture, making Michigan one of three target states to reform civil forfeiture laws. You can find out more by going to their website, fixforfeiture.org. That's fixforfeiture.org. Holly, thank you so much for talking with us on Stateside.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Meet Mike Ellison.
I was born in the beautiful country of Ethiopia. I was raised in Virginia and transformed into an artist here in Detroit.
And you can hear that fusion of cultures in his music. Some of it combines traditional African music with modern hip-hop. Michigan Radio's Emily Fox chatted with him about how he uses his music as a tool for education and community outreach.
This is a rhythm, a warrior's rhythm, a joyous rhythm, a glorious rhythm. Yahoo! Uh-huh. Yahoo! Uh-huh. You hear it, you feel it, it's there in the spirit, it's there in the lyric, don't ever compare it. Yahoo! Uh-huh. Yahoo! Uh-huh. The beat of the cradle, defeating the label, the people are able to eat at the table now. Yahoo! Uh-huh. Yahoo! Uh-huh. Divine up our cheddar, we gotta get better, united together, we tighter than ever now. Yahoo! Uh-huh. Yahoo! Forsaken, forever mistreated, debated, disputed, but never defeated. No hate, no more venom, we straight with the rhythm. We celebrate rhythm, we elevate rhythm. The beautiful rhythm, the powerful rhythm. We chant to the rhythm, we dance to the rhythm. The beautiful rhythm, the powerful rhythm. We chant to the rhythm, we dance to the rhythm.
That song is called Warrior's Rhythm, and it's part of a project by Mike Ellison called Afroflow. Mike now joins us in the studio. And Mike, you were born in Ethiopia. What was life like in Ethiopia before you moved to the United States, and why did your family leave?
You know, they left because there was a lot of political upheaval in the 70s when Emperor Haile Selassie was ousted by a fascist government So it was a very rough political time. So my family left for safety reasons. Prior to that, though, everything that my mother and father told me about Ethiopia was positive. Everything my brother and sister talked about, the beautiful people, the land, the culture, the history. So I always grew up with a very positive image of Ethiopia and of Africa and of myself. My mother always called me her Ethiopian child, her African child. So as opposed to the poster child for poverty pictures we always see of Ethiopia, I grew up with the history of the cornerstone of civilization and kings and queens and culture and mathematics and science and philosophy and music and art. That was my understanding of Ethiopia.
And how do you think your roots in Ethiopia shaped you as a person and as a performer?
As a person, you know, it gave me a sense of identity and purpose because, you know, we're seeing a very volatile time in our country right now as far as race relations are concerned. As African Americans, we grow up very confused because we don't know exactly where we're from. And we're pretty much taught a misguided view of history from the time we enter school. We're not told anything about Africa. We're starting with slavery, which is a horrible place for a child to start to identify him or herself. And so for me, I always considered Ethiopia my home. And everything that I was taught about Ethiopia was positive and powerful. So that gave me a tremendous sense of self-love. And as an artist, it gave me direction, you know, because you know, when you're trying to break into music, you're in this crew or that crew or this production company, and you're trying to figure out this business that nobody really gives you a roadmap for. And once I decided to just forego all of that, forget about the industry and focus on artistry, and then I started reconnecting with Ethiopia and going back to Ethiopia and contributing to causes in Ethiopia, it gave me a sense of purpose that was greater than myself.
You have a song on your Afroflow album called Mickey Number One, and it criticizes international aid efforts in Africa. Let's take a listen.
I'm fed up with the drama because I got love for my people. We want respect, we want honor. We all just want to be equal. The evil, rich, and united keep using tricks to divide us. The wealthy countries call it aid, but it's all a charade. I'm unafraid to make it plain and make it known upon the microphone because nothing can replace the love you show me every time I'm home. I got a purpose, dropping verses in the sun and get inspired by the kids that call me Mickey Number One. They call me Mickey.
Tell me more about the message you're sending in the song.
Well, because it does criticize international aid efforts because some of them are legitimate and some of them are not so legitimate. And some of them further disenfranchise the people and they don't work their way down to the people who need it. That's a major problem. Here in the U.S., we hear charity, 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 aid, 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 aid. Well, you know, if we're going back to the history of Africa, let's put it this way. You know, if I come to your house and I steal your TV, and then you say, hey, Mike, you know, the Super Bowl is coming on. I'd really like to watch the Super Bowl. And I give you your TV back. Is that aid? Not so much. So that's what's happening a lot in Africa in so-called third world countries, which by itself is a demeaning term. I like to refer to them as redeveloping countries, right? Because all of our civilizations are based on these countries and what they did thousands of years ago. So I would look at them as redeveloping and not third world. That's kind of like calling somebody a second or third class citizen.
Spit it for the orphan children living in the villages with very little privileges and no more living relatives. I show you just how real it is. We criticize the system. They turn around like hypocrites and stigmatize the victims of HIV disease, adults, teens, and even children. It wasn't that disease, it was our ignorance that killed them. I ain't feeling this division, religion, the tribal differences. Exploited by the powerful nations who find it interesting.
You use music and other art forms to reach out to youth in Detroit. Tell me more about what you're doing to give back to Detroit right now.
Basically, when we have the opportunity, and I say we, I mean, I have a team of people and amazing artists that I work with. You know, we use our music as an opportunity to enlighten youth, to wake them up, to help inspire them to pursue their passions. So whether it's a production like Broken Mirrors, Bullies and Bystanders, which uses music, multimedia, and dance to explore this topic of bullying and teen suicide, or whether it's using that music to delve into African history. You know, we take the productions into the schools, and these are professional musicians who travel the world, and they give their time and support my productions to come in and teach these students.
You're performing at a music festival in Detroit tomorrow. It's called Concert of Colors. It combines both world and Detroit music. And you'll be putting on a performance along with other artists that will incorporate music, dance, spoken word, and drama. And you're calling your show Hard Enough to Smile. What's the meaning behind that title?
Hard Enough to Smile addresses several issues. One, as black men, we are being portrayed in the media and often through our music as these monolithic thugs who don't smile, who don't love, who don't cry, who don't laugh. And that's just the furthest thing from the truth. So as a man, we're always trying to be hard. But we like to say we're hard enough to smile. When you're secure enough in your manhood, you can smile at another person. You can say hello to another man and not have to grim him like you're about to fight in the middle of an MMA octagon. Do you know what I mean? And then the other part of it is that Detroit and also our history as African-Americans in this country has been very hard from the start, from the beginning to Obama. It's been tough. But no matter what, we've always maintained our smile. And so what we want to show people in this production is the full range of who we are as people and as men, and also to show our resiliency in the tribulations we face.
I've been speaking with Mike Ellison. You can see him perform in Detroit tomorrow night at 8 p.m. He'll be at the Charles H. Wright Museum of African American History. It's part of the Concert of Colors Music Festival, which continues throughout this weekend in Midtown Detroit. His latest hip-hop album will be fully released this year. You can find more information online at mikeellison.me. Mike, have a great show, and thanks for chatting today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Meanwhile, I'm motivated by the Motor City Child, facing gangs, failing schools, and incredible odds. Thank God certain teachers reaching pockets and purses to purchase supplies of worth the system won't provide. Divide pain on both sides of the sea, and there's me, swimming in the middle of a critical riddle. If a father's on a cliff with one arm and two sons falling down, you tell me how he's supposed to choose one. I'm on a cliff with one arm and two sons, America, Africa, and I'm supposed to choose one, right?
Choose one, right, right, right.
That's why I'm hard enough to smile, man enough to cry, strong enough to live, but I'm willing to die, cause I believe in it. Yeah, do you believe in it?
I'm
hard enough to smile, man enough to cry.
Today's Stateside was directed by Ellie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark, and today's engineer was Peg Watson. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Ryan Grimes, Ava Obrecht, Jake Offenhartz, Shayna Roth, and Katrina Schaefer. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.